Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. And sometimes I feel like just a plebeian on a circuitous drive through this UFO topic. You're going to have to Google that. A friend of mine was, and I was talking this weekend, and she had some interesting words, so I thought I'd look some of them up, and that's what I am. Anyway, I want to thank you all for listening. We have a fun show this evening. We have Ron Felber. He's going to be talking about the Mojave incident. We're going to be getting into that. We're going to take a little sidestep halfway through the show, or some part way through the show, to talk about another book he's working on. That's very interesting. Unfortunately, it's not about UFOs. Don't get mad at me about that. Thursday, we have Paul Hynek on. I'm really excited about this show because it has nothing to do with UFOs. We may mention it. But he was part of a study out of Stanford. They did some gene therapy, and he is the first person tested that's ever tested younger, about 4 years younger with these therapies. And so we're going to be doing a show on the Everything Else show. That's this coming Thursday night, and that's 8 p.m. Eastern time. So you may want to check that out to get to those shows. I am, when I can, I'll put those out in the mailing list. To get on our mailing list for our weekly newsletter, all you have to do is go to podcastufo.com. And on the sidebar, you'll see sign up for the weekly newsletter. And so when I have those shows, I think I'm going to throw out a newsletter for that. But also, you can subscribe to our YouTube channel and just click the little button, the little bell, and that'll give you, that'll send you email notifications of when I have a stream going up, because those shows are going to be done on random nights, random topics about things that I find interesting. You may not, so you can skip the ones you don't find particularly interesting. The blog this evening is by Charles Lear, as usual. It's become like a four-part series now. The 1976 UFO encounter in Kentucky. And this week, he talks about the investigation. He has one more. Let's see. And that one, I think, is the evidence. That is how he's going to top that one off on the four-part four series of that. So, I want to thank everyone that supports the show, and anyone that wants to do that, all you have to do is go to Patreon or go through our website, podcastufo.com, under support the show, under that tab, and you can support the show there if you'd like. I do appreciate every single listener. Thank you all. I've been getting some wonderful feedback. Unfortunately, I'm getting a lot of email that I just, and I've said this a number of times, and people kind of tease me about it. But it's much better to send me brief emails instead of these four-page ones, because I have some type of ADHD or something like that. I have a hard time reading those very long emails. A lot of people are sending me their sightings. I do have on my website, podcastufo.com, I have a tab for if someone would like to anonymously post their sightings. Also, there is information for MUFON and Peter Davenport's site, New Fork, where you can report your sites as well. Either way, I welcome your email, and I will try to respond to every one of them. I know I'm behind. It's been pretty busy, and I will try to get to all of your emails. So that is about enough of me talking, and I think it's time for me to bring in our guest. He's a noted author. He used to be a policeman at one time, and he did some research and a great book on the Mojave incident. You're not going to find a whole lot about it if you're researching online. So I like to have these type of stories and to find out more information about them. Ron, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Martin. Thank you.
Yes. And so, as always, I do appreciate for you to come on and talk about this. This is an old book. It's not a new book, right?
Yeah, actually, it was published under the title Searchers. Originally, and that would have been, back a few years. Then it did very well, and so we republished it and in some new editions under the title Mojave Incident.
Now, did I know I haven't talked about this off air or anything, but do I recall a movie that was something like this in a desert and people in a camper or something like that?
Well, you know, Paranormal Witness did a show, an hour documentary on the Mojave incident, I guess about 2 or 3 years ago. And also Beyond Belief did an hour documentary on it. So, yes.
Oh, before I forgot to do this in my monologue, and that is I wanted to pay tribute to someone we lost yesterday, and that's Douglas Trumbull. Douglas is a past guest on the show, but he was an amazing person. He was a special effects producer. He's known for the Space Odyssey, 2001, mm-hmm. Space Odyssey. That was one of his big ones. Many, many through the year. Real fine gentleman, a real close friend to Mark D'Antonio. I called him today, and so he will be missed. And so I just wanted to pass that along. Anyway, so as we continue, sorry about that. I had just forgotten to talk about it. Anyway, he was a past guest. I got to meet him out in Phoenix, and a real swell gentleman. And so getting back to this incident and your involvement in, I guess I have to ask you this, Ron. I always ask people to talk a little bit about their background and how they got interested in this topic. But I do want to know how you found out about this topic and you wrote about it, and why isn't it out there if for someone to research? I mean, it's pretty major, right?
I mean, as a matter of fact, a lot of people, one of the critics called it the most frightening UFO book ever written. And, you know, some others have said that it's a must read for anybody not only interested in the topic, but anybody that's interested in the possibilities of human existence. And so the way I came upon it, I was not a ufologist. I was a writer doing thrillers. I wrote the Nick Carter series. I did some work for True Detective magazine and a few novels. But I was also running a company, and this would have been back in 2015, that kind of time frame, maybe a little before that. And there was a fellow that worked for me who I became friends with. He was out on the West Coast. I was on the East Coast. And so when I went to the West Coast on business, I would have a dinner with him and maybe a drink or two. And as we got to be friends, he knew I was a writer, of course, and told me about his best friend, who he had played varsity football with at the University of Redlands. And the incident that happened to him that really changed his life, changed his wife's life, and changed his family's life, something that he was morbidly shy about discussing and very reluctant because he considered it really deeply personal. But since this was his best friend, and I was a very good friend of his, he thought it would maybe be therapeutic in some way for this fellow and his wife, this would be Steve and Dawn Hess, to tell me their story. From my standpoint, I had no great interest in a UFO story per se, but because he was my friend, I agreed to meet with them in California, and I was just staggered by the story and the depth and the breadth of the story and how credible these people were. And so I decided to work with them, and we worked very hard for a couple of years, putting the story together, verifying things with psychologists and psychiatrists, and even a polygraph test and retrogressive hypnosis. So as you mentioned, I was a policeman. I was a deputy sheriff, and I worked with federal prisoners for about 3 years. So I approached this like a detective would.
I was going to ask you that. And I think that is, I've had a number of policemen, former policemen retired on this show over the years. Every single one of them say the same thing. It was very helpful. And also observing the witness testimony.
Yes.
The watching for the key elements that look, real or not so real when they're, authentic.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, is just the backgrounds of these individuals. The husband was a project manager. So he was in charge of construction programs like for shopping malls. And, so multi-million-dollar budgets, a lot of people working under him and for him. And so he was an incredibly credible, very credible individual. They had two children, and his wife, Dawn, was equally credible. She was a college graduate. They were college sweethearts and got married. And really from all any way you wanted to approach it, this is sort of the backbone of America kind of people, you know, very straightforward, very credible, not prone to fantasy or anything like that. You know, this is a construction man involved with construction. So, sort of a man's man, a hunter, a former varsity football player in college, somebody that you had to take seriously. If they say this happened, you had to listen.
Right. So let's hear their story and what you got from them. Set the whole thing up, if you would, how it all began and the whole incident.
Yeah, I'll do my best. It's, you know, I talk about it like it sort of was pulling a curtain back on a different reality. Mm-hmm. This isn't like somebody that's, you know, in Montana or in the Midwest driving a long distance haul on it in a truck, stops and sees something and takes a picture of it or you know, tells somebody about it later. This was a full blown scenario that took place over the course of maybe 12 hours with two individuals simultaneously witnessing the same things, again, with duration. So it wasn't a glimpse at something. It was a real being immersed into another world.
Hmm.
It started out like a lot of things do, I guess, with married couples with new children. So they had two children at the time, and I believe the ages were 4 and 2.5. And so the mom, who was a full-time stay-at-home mom at the time, wanted to get away. He had his parents as babysitters. So the grandparents offered to babysit for a weekend. And the wife said, you know, I just want to go out. I want to listen to some music. I want to dance. I want to, you know, have a dinner out. And that's what I'm looking for the weekend. In the meantime, the husband had different ideas. This was his vacation too, and he'd been working really hard on the construction of a mall. And so a year prior to that, he'd been hunting with his father and his brother, and he missed a fairly easy shot at a mule deer in the Mojave Desert where they were hunting. The father was philosophical about it. The brother, not so much. He gave him a real hard time about missing the shot. And so he was hell bent on going back to the Mojave and getting the mule deer.
No.
So this obviously wasn't in the wife's plans. So being the intelligent couple that they are, they made a compromise. And the compromise was that they would, it would go to the Mojave, but on the way, there was a place called Whiskey Pete's. And they would stop at Whiskey Pete's. They have a good dinner. There was a band that would play, you know, country music. They would do some dancing. They'd have a couple of drinks. And that would be, you know, her night out. From there, they would drive a short distance to the Mid-Hills campsite. And they would stay there overnight and then go into the Mojave and do his hunting. And they'd camp out in a camper that they had.
Mm-hmm.
So, all seemed like it was going well. The grandparents came and they were on their way, and they did go to Whiskey Pete's and they did the dancing that they wanted to and had the dinner that they wanted. But when they got to the Mid-Hills campsite, very much out of the ordinary, it was completely sold out. So they had no place to camp. Mm-hmm. Well, this was kind of a disappointment to Steve, but more than a disappointment to Dawn, because the alternative was to go into the desert where they were going to go hunting in their camper into a very, you know, desolate area near Tabletop Mountain in the New York mountain range. And she had misgivings. She had read articles that, you know, the motorcycle gangs did mm-hmm. drugs there, and there were drug transactions, and occasionally they'd find, you know, somebody dead body or something in some kind of drug deal that went wrong. And she was very concerned about that. And so they went anyway, and Steve promised her a nice steak dinner, that they'd make a campfire, it would be romantic, etc. And they did. So they went to the into the desert, again, a very desolate area, surrounded by mountains and kind of a valley, you know, with the mountains surrounding it. And they made the campfire. They had some wine. They ate a steak or two. And as the evening started to fall, Steve, who had had a UFO experience when he was 12 years old, he'd been fishing and camping with his parents and another set of parents, and he and his friend were fishing, and he had this vivid memory, you know, etched into his mind of a UFO that appeared over Lake Mojave while they were fishing and seemed to follow them. Mm-hmm. And they ran from it. They dropped their fishing rods and ran. They ran back to their parents and told them that there was a flying saucer. And their parents, of course, who were having a good time with their neighbors, didn't see that as a very credible thing and sort of laughed it off. But to Steve, it was not a laughing matter. It was something that really made an impression on him. So while they're at the campfire and darkness is starting to fall, he feels this sensation of being watched. So he looks to his right over his shoulder, and almost like somebody peeking from behind the mountain, a UFO appears. Maybe 30 feet in diameter, just juts out. He looks at it. It looks at him, or seems to, and slips back behind the mountain. Now, Dawn, who is already nervous, he doesn't want to say anything about it, because the last thing she needs to hear is that he just saw a UFO
behind
the mountain. So he buries it, you know, himself.
Yeah.
And they go on. And later in the evening, they are stargazing. So Steve, who is a really intelligent guy and very well informed, you know, knew the constellations and how they were set up. And he's explaining to his wife, well, this is this particular constellation, and you see how the stars are here. And you see that one over there, that's a double star. And you can see that it's brighter than the others, and its shape is a little different. So she says, well, if that's a double star, this one must be a triple star. And in the mountain range, not far away, I would say 400 yards away, 500 yards away, above the mountain is this glowing orb. So Steve swallows hard when he sees this, because all of this starts to come together from the time he was 12 to the sighting he had just had to this, which he has no explanation for. It's not a triple star. So they talk about that for a moment, and Dawn understands that he's a little bit shaken now. And as they're watching, as they're observing, the one glowing orb becomes 9 glowing orbs. And over the mountain range, again, maybe 500 yards from them, the 9 glowing orbs form the configuration of an M. And so Dawn looks to him, what's going on? What is that? And the only thing he can think of is maybe it's Nellis Air Force Base is not too far away, that maybe it's some experimental craft or some craft that are on a maneuver or testing. And so he says that. But while they're saying that, the 9 become dozens, and the dozens become hundreds. And the noise in the desert at night is noisy. Stops. All of a sudden, it feels as though the valley is capped, as if it's capped.
You mean like a vacuum of noise?
Yes, no noise, and just the feeling that the valley is capped by something. a ceiling almost.
Mm.
So now they're moving towards a kind of panic. A voice, a telepathic voice, very clear in Dawn's head, says, don't do anything rash. We're not going to harm you. You know, don't do anything rash. In the meantime, Steve runs to the camper, gets out a shotgun and a Browning rifle that he was going to be using for hunting, and is ready to defend. Now they don't think about a maneuver because it's so massive. They think it's an invasion. They think that maybe it's the Russians, or that's the first thing that came to their mind. It's the Russians. This is an invasion.
That? Wow.
And so Steve is ready to defend. I mean, as ridiculous as that sounds, people in moments of panic do things that aren't necessarily totally rational. But he picks up the guns, and then Dawn hears another sort of voice, telepathic, don't put the gun down. Don't try to fight us or we'll kill you.
Oh, geez.
She takes the gun, pulls it down, said, don't do that. And now he hears the voice. And the voice says, get in the camper, put the guns down, sit in the camper, behind in the back of the camper. So almost as if in a daze or in a robotic sort of way, they walk to the back of the camper like people that are hypnotized. Mm-hmm. And they sit Indian style, him with the guns across his lap and her next to him in the back of the camper. Soon after, they look out of the camper window and they see the hundreds of orbs dropping to the ground. And as they drop to the ground, there's an onrushing of what they describe as gremlins, red eyes. And so in the night, what they see are pairs, hundreds of pairs of red eyes rushing towards them. So this is, of course, again, they're starting to feel like they're going to have a heart attack or something. And they try to move. But again, what emerges are two almost like fire plugs that are electrified. And so when they move forward a foot, it moves for these two things move forward a foot, and there's an electrical charge. So when Steve tries to leave the camper, he gets jolted back by this tremendous force of electricity. And I guess you don't try that more than once or twice before you realize you're trapped.
Can you explain that, what you mean exactly? Like, this is something that came inside the camper?
Yes, at the lip of the camper.
What did it look like?
They call them like stumps. That's what they call them, like stumps. That's the way they describe them. So if you think of maybe a fire hydrant.
Yeah.
Yeah, something, you know, that maybe is a couple of feet high and maybe 8 or 10 inches across, but electrified, and two of them. So that basically this is an electrified fence. Think of it that way. Think of an invisible fence for a dog.
And this thing just popped up in there?
Yes.
Their sleeper?
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
So now they realize they're trapped, and obviously this is a terrible feeling. The red-eyed, I'll call them gremlins because that's the word that they use, are malevolent. They're in a frenzy. These things are full of energy, frenzied, animalistic. They have like leather kind of faces, you know, black faces that are leather, that leathery, shiny red eyes like lasers. And they surround the camper. They're on top of the camper. They're in the trees. They're everywhere. And frenetic. So at this point, this would be the first set of beings, if you want to call them that, dwarfish, almost diabolical. And what happens next is they look up or look around, and above them is a huge UFO that literally that they can see now.
Now wait a minute. They're in the camper. How can they see above them?
They have windows. So there's the camper, and it has a window in the front and windows on the side.
So they could see this thing that it looked like it was over them, like at an angle or something.
But it was huge. So this thing is so big that it capped the valley. So in other words, if you think of if you think of your purview like this, you can look up. But this thing, they're talking about something the size of a football field.
Hmm.
And they're talking about it not being, thousands of feet up. You're talking about something that maybe is 100 feet up, 150 feet up. Uh-huh. So, I mean, it's very visible to them. And not only that, they can feel it. A beam of light, a probe, they called it, with a diameter of about 30 feet, starts to send things up, pick up things. And they see, desert animals and cactus and trees and things like that being sucked up into this huge UFO. And there's a triangular vehicle that they call a searcher. And the searcher starts to comb the desert basin. And they smell a smell a lot like a burning rubber.
Hmm.
Or sulfur, and they feel the ground shaking, and they think that, in retrospect, they think that maybe it's a mining operation of some kind, that they're combing the desert for looking for minerals, or something, and it's a search. So they called it a searcher. So they're observing this tremendous odor around them. Suffocating odor. They're trapped in this camper. They're watching the searcher comb the basin of the desert. The probe is bringing things up, and in this light, this incredibly white light, and what's beamed down then are nine other beings, and these are what they call illuminated figures. They're bright. Like white, and they are surround the camper. When the shades are pulled, the curtains are pulled on the camper window, it makes no difference. These things are so illuminated.
Hmm.
And they talked about this particular type like scientists. They were studying them. They were surrounding the camper and were studying them. And they got mental telepathic signals that they were being studied and that they were being observed. And at that point, it became, I won't say torture because torture implies an intent. The intent, I don't think, was to torture. But in effect, that's what it was, because they were put through a battery of emotions.
So were they ever physically examined, or is this all at a distance?
We'll get to that.
Oh, okay. Well, another thing while I'm pausing you here.
Yeah, sure.
Is were they like just absolutely freaking out? How were they handling this?
That's really a good question. And they thought they were in hell. They thought they had died and were in hell. Hmm. They thought that they were having heart attacks. Hmm. And they were pinching each other literally and saying, tell me exactly what you see. Describe to me exactly what you're seeing to make sure that this wasn't all some kind of bizarre dream and they really were together and they really were seeing the same things. And so they would describe to each other the detail of what they were seeing. And of course they realized that it was more than real. It was super real. And when they felt their chests were about to explode, a kind of mist came into the camper, and it must've been a kind of, trying to think of the word, a suppressant to calm them. Mm-hmm. And so they realized at some point in time that probably they would have died were it not for this mist that sedated them or calmed them, like a tranquilizer effect. But they needed to be kept alive because these illuminated beings, like scientists, were experimenting on them. They didn't want them to die. And so they were kept alive. At that point, as I say, they started praying. They worried about, Dawn worried about their children at home, that somehow they were involved in all of this and that they were in grave danger. So it was a hellish, nightmarish experience. And even a word like torture doesn't capture it because, you know, torture can be for a period of time, but this was sustained. And what they were forced to do was to relive emotions. So, for example, I'll give you one I don't want to dwell on. One of the reasons that Dawn was concerned about going into the desert was because she had been assaulted, molested as a child. And so she was forced not to remember, but to relive those experiences because they wanted to evoke the emotion that that experience created. Wow. So if it was terror, if it was humiliation, if it was shame, they wanted to evoke those emotions. In Steve's case, and sometimes they were like joyous moments. Sometimes they were moments of triumph, let's say as a football player. Since he was a hunter, he was made to live a scenario where he was being hunted like an animal. And hunters were chasing him, and he was in, you know, a mad dash to get away and to hide and whatnot. And eventually in this scenario, he's wounded, can't go on. The hunters capture him. The hunters gut him. And basically, you know, that's another one of the experiences that he lived or relived or was forced to. But again, the idea was to evoke emotion, sadness, fear, joy, exaltation. So another one that Dawn had was with her child, and the vision or the vignette that she was forced to live in was that her child, was born with a defect. Yeah. And that when she went to see the child was not normal, was a monstrous child.
And so they were envisioning these type of things?
I want to make it clear, more than envisioning, being in the scenario, being in it, living it.
Okay.
Pardon me, just one
second. I'm just trying to lay this out and I think it's important for the listener. That's why I'm asking. These illuminated figures that I'm picturing them, they're outside the camp or are they inside the camp?
They're outside the camper.
But they're all doing this. They're somehow doing this through the walls of the camper and they're just fastened right in there.
Exactly.
The way they're seated in the back of their camp with those.
And again, if you picture the camper had windows on the side, horizontal windows on each side.
Yeah.
And then the back of the camper was open.
Yeah.
And on the lip of it were these two electrified beings or devices or whatever that trapped them in there.
Yeah.
The illuminated figures they described very vividly. They had a mouth like a slit, two holes for a nose. They were the grays. I mean, as you know, people would describe them, large eyes. And that's what, of course, was the most salient feature. And Dawn describes looking in the eyes of these things and said they're not human eyes. They didn't have the pieces that the pupil, the cornea, yeah, et cetera, that a human would have.
Yeah.
And so this was the scenario that went on for hours. And they were kept alive during all of this. And then when they think they're mad, when they think they're absolutely insane with terror and just adrenaline pumping and the brain going a mile a minute and their heart pounding, it seems like they withdraw. So it seems like the gremlin type beings withdraw when there's an army of them. It seems like the illuminated figures withdraw, and they're saying, praying, literally praying, God help us, God protect our children, etc. But then they come back again in force. And again, this is almost, again, a way to play with emotions, to play with their minds. And so that it's totally demoralizing when this happens. However, and this is what almost gives the story a religious context. What happens after this, and when they are completely out of their minds and completely beside themselves with horror, they see an angelic presence. They feel it, and they see it in the clouds, and it's a sort of angel. They call it their comforter, because this feminine, clearly feminine presence, like a giant angel descending, comforts them. You're going to survive this. Your children are okay. This will be over soon. And it seems as if this angelic presence is on a different level, a higher level, certainly than the gremlins and the scientific beings, the illuminated figures as well, that this is a sort of a more commanding presence. And at that time, they start to withdraw, really withdraw. And they feel very sleepy, almost like they're drugged. And they sleep.
Yeah.
However, just before they actually, are unconscious, they feel the camper being lifted up. They hear this sound like the mining operation, that I, this deep rumbling in the ground and this pungent odor, that almost the ground is being cut out around them and lifted up through this beam into the spaceship. And that's the last thing they remember. When they wake up in the morning, they know now obviously time has passed because it was night. Now it's the sun is out. The campfire is dead. They're out of the camper. And they're sort of sprawled on the ground, fully clothed, and incredibly, totally disoriented. They think the world has ended. They can't imagine that this just happened to them, because of the massive scale of all of this. And so, they put on the radio, and they hear a Randy Travis song, a country western song. And they're expecting to hear news bulletins,
that the world's ending. Yeah.
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 So they drive in the camper, and they're, like I said, disoriented. And there's an elderly couple that's, not too far away. And they stop and ask them, did you see, but reluctantly, did anything unusual happen? Did you see anything unusual last night? So the woman says, no, we went to bed early, and no, we don't know of anything unusual.
Do you know about, excuse me, just one second. Please. Do you know about how far away that couple was from where they were camping?
Yeah, my guess, I never asked that question to them, but just the way the context of what, of the story and how they told it, I would say, 5 miles, 3 miles,
okay.
Not a long, long distance away. So they wind up going back to their their home in La Mirada. And, you know, it doesn't end there. It doesn't end there.
Wow. If we were, you know, we can, you want to take a break right now and then we can come back and continue on? I can certainly do that. But I, before we do, I do have some questions that came up. And questions, I always ask people to put them in all caps. And I thank you for doing that. And some of the people here that did that, I just want to bring up. There was this one right here. Has Ron ever corroborated any of the details?
You mentioned- this is sort of the second part of the story, is what happens after this. And what happens after this is a very thorough investigation of all the details.
Oh, okay. All right. So just going to ask another, there's a couple more questions about the orbs.
Yes.
Do you know anything about the colors or the properties of the orbs? And are you assuming that these little dwarf-like gremlin-type things came out of the orbs?
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes. And you could almost think of them as parachuting down in these orbs.
Wow. And I wonder what their purpose was in all this. And any description of the orbs, the colors or properties?
Yeah, you know? They were white. And the searcher, the thing that was combing the triangular device, or let's call it a device, or I don't know another word for it. It was multicolored. So it was blue, red, white, and it flashed different colors as it was prowling around and scanning the desert basin.
Wow. Wow. Amazing. Let's see. So this is kind of a long one here. I was trying to read it while you were talking. A vast majority of the abduction phenomena seems to be either scientific study and or biological operations. Does Ron have a comment on that? And please elaborate beyond the basics.
Sure. You know, under hypnosis, and I guess we'll get to this in the second half, but under hypnosis, they have incredibly detailed explanations, even to the point where Dawn has, when she's hypnotized and retrogressed, starts talking in almost a different voice. So it's a robotic cadence, staccato voice. As if it were being channeled, and explains what the aliens want, what they're here for, and where it will lead.
Jeez, very interesting. Let me see. Here's another one here. Please ask you if there's any further detail in the communication between these people and them, or these beings in them, which I always think is interesting, this type of telepathy. Do you know if the telepathy was like English words or visions or
it what? Wasn't visions. It was like a voice.
Like a voice.
Yeah.
Amazing. And another one here. And this is, you know, the gremlins sort of sound demonic. Michael wants to know, is this possible demonic?
This is actually, you know, again, we'll get to this, I think, in the second half, but they were pretty dysfunctional after all of this, you know, and dysfunctional in that it's almost like you hear about astronauts, the guys that went to the moon. So you go to the moon. What's next? You know, how do you follow that up? You say, what am I going to do that's greater than being one of the first, you know, men on the moon? Yeah. And the answer is probably nothing. And so the way Steve in particular felt, he had no desire to work. Everything became meaningless to him. Yeah. Everything became trite and of no, because he believed, and they believed, and I believe that what they saw was another world, another existence, bigger than our own, integrally involved with our own. And he knows it, and no one else does.
Yeah. Well, you know, I totally get how that would just make you fall apart, something like that. I totally would. I would be that person for sure.
Me too. I'm afraid of that
thing. Yeah.
What do you get excited about? I mean, why don't you go build a mall? You know, it all seems so senseless and so pointless.
Right.
You're talking about eternity.
Right. Right. Well, thank you. All right. We're going to go into our break. Thank you, Ron. We'll be right back in about 2.5 minutes. This is a clip from the National Archives, and it's about the Gulf Breeze incident. I just thought it was kind of interesting, and these are always free to post, so here it goes.
Ordinary sighting of an unidentified flying object. These pictures, taken over a six-month period in Gulf Breeze, Florida, are the most spectacular evidence of UFOs ever gathered. While some say the photos are fakes, that would not explain the fact that more than 20 people have reported seeing these objects on the very same nights. Charles Summerby describes what he saw in the skies.
No sound. There was no veering. It was a straight course. And halfway out over the bay, and so I'd never seen anything like that. There were portholes. We saw portholes of light coming out of the portholes.
The man who took these pictures insists on remaining anonymous, so we'll call him Jim. We had a narrator read a transcript of our interview. Jim says his most threatening encounter with the UFOs occurred on this road. He says an object swooped over his car and sent out a beam of light.
And it came through the windshield, hit my exposed arms, and turned my skin to like it was asleep, but even worse, and then you don't have any feeling at all. I proceeded to panic.
Forced off the road, Jim fumbled with the camera, managing to snap this one dramatic picture. A noted optical physicist calculated the object was hovering about 3 feet off the ground. Photography experts say such a picture would be virtually impossible to fake.
Shooting out of the windshield of the car, through the windshield of the car, and being able to reproduce this object down the road, reflecting on the surface of the road, I feel would be very difficult to do.
But not everyone buys that argument. The mayor of Gulf Breeze is convinced the UFO reports are an elaborate hoax that are damaging to the image of his city.
I want to go on record as the mayor and express to all the population viewing this telecast that we...
Well, that's it for that break, and I see our guest has gotten up and left. He should be back in a minute, and so thank you all for listening to the show. Interesting story. The second part of the show, we're going to be continuing on what happened, and then we're going to be taking calls. We can take calls probably a little bit earlier than the typical time, which is the last half hour of the show, and that number will be 855-472-5483. Bill will be standing by to take a call. I'm not sure where our guest went, but hopefully he will be back. I can see that he's gone right now. So a couple of things. In June, the first part of June this year, last year, I was at the Pine Bush UFO conference. That's going to be the first part of June this year. I'm looking forward to that. And I'm going to try to do, I don't know, the timing is off, but I might do some pre-recording with some guests that are going to be there, speakers that are going to be there. And let's see, coming up, we have next week, we have Chris Lambright. He'll be coming up. And for those of you who watch this YouTube channel, we had an Albert Wayne. He was on, he told an incredible UFO encounter story. And I decided to have him on because he had some things happen in his family as well. He's going to be on for a whole hour. Kevin Randall, the first hour. This is coming up, I think, the first March 1st or first part of March. Kevin Randall will be on for the first hour. And Albert Wayne will be on. He's going to elaborate more onto that incredible UFO encounter that he had. And for those of you who watch my channel, you'll know this when I say this. It was when everyone that pulled over on I-95 got off, they pulled over to watch this UFO. They ended up getting off on the first exit that came up, and they all pulled into the Howard Johnson's, and most of them got ice cream. That is quite a story. Anyway, so bringing back our guest tonight. Hey, Ron, thanks for coming back. So,
my pleasure.
So now okay, we left off where they're going home, and it sounds like something else is going to happen.
Yeah, you know, I guess you hit on it when you said, you know, what were they feeling? You know, so what is their mental state after this?
Yeah,
and you know, disoriented again is it doesn't cover the base. You know, terrified, confused. Exalted in a way, like, why us? What is going on? Have we seen? Are we special? What is going on here? But you have to realize that even from the very beginning, this is not something they wanted to talk about. And so, reluctantly, when their parents, the grandparents, Steve's parents, sees them, and they come back, she's really concerned about her children, and he is. You know, they're like different people. So the parents know that something has happened, and very reluctantly, they tell the story. And this, by the way, is a couple days later that they work up the nerve, they discuss it, you know, should we tell them? And they do, and they're, I think, gravely disappointed, because while the parents are empathetic, The thing is the kind of thing that you hear, like, I'm sure that you think this happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is probably worse than saying, I think you're a liar.
Right. Or it's about the same. Yeah.
Because it's such a passive aggressive sort of thing. I'm sure you think that this happened. And so they're very reluctant to tell anyone. And that's really when I came onto the scene, maybe 6 months after this happened to them. They and again, I don't like to get into too many details about their personal life, but they can't eat, they can't sleep, they're sexually dysfunctional. They're just not, you know, nothing seems to be the same. They're terribly paranoid about their children. They're afraid that somehow Dawn, who while she was in the camper, one of the illuminated beings, flips a finger. And something like the burning part of a cigarette, the lit part of a cigarette, comes off of his fingertip, its fingertip, and into her abdomen. And so she's really concerned that somehow something's been taken from her, maybe an ovary, or that somehow,
like, this thing went right through the window or something.
Yes, exactly, and that she's been impregnated. She's very concerned about that, because that's something that she does remember. So when they get home, for example, they have terrible nightmares. And this, of course, just causes them to have insomnia, to be paranoid. Every creak in the house, every loud noise, the psychiatrist who saw them, there were two, said they had all the symptoms of a POW. And so, for example, in the middle of the night, they hear their oldest child, who was 4 and a half at the time, screaming, screaming bloody murder. They rush into his room, and he's spinning like a top.
Oh, geez.
The mother scoops him up in her arms and embraces him, and he's, you know, he's hysterical. And says, you know, there are monsters. There are monsters in my room. And so, of course, Steve says, you know, there is no such thing as monsters. There are no monsters. He goes, there are. They're little, and they're mean, and they have red eyes.
Oh, God.
So
this is what, right now, you hear this all the time, called the hitchhiker effect. Have you ever heard that term? Like, something will follow you. And that's what it sounds like happened here.
Yeah, there's another situation, and I'll read it if you don't mind. Can I do that?
Yeah, as long as it's not real long. Yeah,
sure. No, it's not long at all.
Yeah,
it's not. Well, I just want to give you the description of. It's not long at all. The description of what they look like. So it's a June 12th, 1990, 3:05 a.m. It was 4 weeks later, in the dead of early morning, that the dreams recurred with an intensity unlike any of the others. In his, Steve saw himself back in the camper, trapped and screaming, while the illuminated creatures encircled him. He was screaming, but there was no sound. Then he saw a flashing image. It was of a long, narrow tunnel with lights running along the sides, but then it was gone again. Then he saw a being who was all white, the color of the tunnel light. Again, he saw a flashing image, and it was of several beings like that. They were trying to restrain him. Then the vision was gone, and only the first figure remained. The being is 4 feet tall. He wears a white, luminous uniform with an upturned arrow on the chest. He has no facial features, no mouth or lips, only slit. He passes directly through the wall. He stands behind the headboard of the bed. He stays there, passes his 3 long fingers over Dawn's face, over and over. Steve can only see the hand. He opens his eyes, and directly above him is the face of the white being. "You're dreaming," he hears the voice say. Then he looks to Dawn's face and sees the burn marks its fingers have left. "Hey, wait a minute," Tom says aloud. "This is no dream." He turned to see Elise and gasped. He was awake. He knew he was awake, and Dawn, had burn marks all over her face. Dawn's eyes opened. The expression on his face scared her. "What? What is it? Go to the mirror," he urged her. "Go to the mirror." Dawn walked to the wall mirror above the chiffonier. "My God, what is this?" she screamed. "Steve, Steve, what have they done? They burned my face." Wow. So this is the kind of thing. This is the kind of
malevolent is a good word, like you used. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So so somebody had asked, is this diabolical? But you know, it's one of these things where, what do you want to call it? I mean, on the one hand, you get these sort of dwarf-like beings that are malevolent, demonic, let's say. You get the others that are sort of scientists and seem to be experimenting. But then above it all, you get this clearly angelic presence that comes down upon them, and it has this incredibly calming effect. And that's why they call her, clearly a feminine presence, call her their comforter. So you could easily see, if you wanted to look at this from sort of a biblical sense, you could see it taking on a religious context, you know, a higher level of good being, a lower level of diabolical being. On the other hand, maybe this is just the way it is. Maybe there is a kind of hierarchy of beings. Maybe there's more than one visitor. Maybe there's different kinds of aliens. And maybe they do combat each other in some way or control each other in a kind of hierarchy. The story is the story. And I think you have to interpret it on your own.
Yeah.
While
you were interviewing them, was this like really hard for them to talk about? And how did you feel comfortable with everything they told you?
Yeah. So this is what happened. I decided to invest a lot of my own personal money in this research. So I had them go to take a polygraph test with a person that did for police, and the FBI did polygraphs. Mm-hmm. Dawn was pregnant at the time, so she didn't take it because pregnant women, because of the electrical impulses, are not supposed to take a polygraph test. But Steve did, and he passed it. So once I had sort of the green light on that, I took them to a friend. I roomed in college at Georgetown with a fellow that became a surgeon. So I hadn't talked to him in years, but I called him and I said, you know, this is the story, and I need the best psychiatrist that you know of or that you could find out about. And I need an introduction to them. And that was Dr. Bernard Vitone. And he actually, there's a small quote from him, but he is the director of the National Center for Psychiatric Disorders in Washington, D.C. And so he examined them, tested them for days. They took tests.
Wow.
He interviewed them. And he said, this is what he quoted, highly unusual, traumatizing events outside the realm of normal human experiences. He compared their condition to that of POWs. And by the way, concluded they were not prone to fantasy. They were not neurotic. They certainly were not psychotic. That these were normal, a little bit above intelligent individuals who were stable and credible. So after that, we eliminated a number of things. One, we eliminated some psychological condition or some condition that would make somebody prone to lying or prone to fantasy. And they were not those people. Then I took them to Asheville, North Carolina, to see Dr. William Annixter. And Dr. Annixter worked with the FBI on, as I said, I was a former law enforcement person. So I sort of plunged into all that and dug out Dr. Annixter, who agreed to retrogress them. So we flew them out to North Carolina, to Asheville. And this is what, to the Mountain Psychiatric Center. And this is what Dr. Annixter had to say. This is the most compelling case of its kind I have ever encountered. And during the retrogression, to answer your question, they were hysterical. They were screaming in terror, and they relived these experiences. They were clearly horrified. And actually, in the middle of a lot of this, Dawn would just say, I want to go home. You know, like a little kid. But through that retrogression came out some incredible truths about what happened to them. They were taken on the craft. They were experimented on. I in the book, there's a lot of the dialogue that was videotaped. And there were some questions asked that went beyond. So they were experimented on the kind of thing you would hear about abduction cases, meaning they were probed. They were very interested in their reproductive systems. They were very interested, as I told you, about their mental capacity.
Now, was she pregnant at the time?
No.
She was not pregnant at that time?
No.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So one of the questions that that was asked was, you know, why are they here? What do they want? And she said, and again, this was in a voice not her own, this sort of staccato voice.
See up here, this question, someone said there was a robotic voice relaying information.
Yes.
So
yes.
Someone obviously has read your book here. It seems like, yeah.
But the answers were just incredible. And here, may I quote from the
sure? Yeah, go ahead. But
go right from the transcript.
Yeah.
Just bear with me one second.
Yeah.
So Dawn, do you have any idea what these beings want or why they're here? This is the doctor. So it was macabre watching her spring up in her chair, suddenly animated and alert. Her voice, rather than soft and emotional, took on a new cadence, which was clipped and direct, quite unlike her. Quote, they want to make contact with the population. Steve and I are specimens, imperfect like the human race. When we're ready to communicate with them face to face, then possibly the world will be too. Her actions, such as edging forward in her chair at the moment, seemed mechanical, as did her voice as she continued. Quote, they have to study our reactions so they know how to approach us. They don't have emotions like ours, so they need us to teach them. They need to understand humans.
Which all makes sense. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If these beings are in contact with you, Tell me what you know about them. And this is where it gets really, I guess, subjective in terms of interpretation. But this is what she answered. God created our world in his image, but not theirs or any of the others. Are there many different kinds of beings? Yes, different ones, different hybrids. When do you think this communication will happen between the aliens and humans? I don't know. In my lifetime? How long will you live? In a normal man's lifetime, in our children's, she said at last.
Wow. Wow.
Stunning, don't you think? I mean, I just find the whole thing stunning.
So and, when they did the regression, you said that that was videoed?
Yes.
Did they video? And were you able to watch that?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
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 I'll read you one last thing that I think your listeners would be really interested in, because I don't think that I know of anything where the answers are so clear. You know, you talked about the universe and matter earlier. You said our universe ends where theirs begins. This is what she said. Our universe ends when its matter stops mattering to us and starts mattering to them. What does that mean? She answers, I don't know. Then she says, the missions these aliens are on, are they friendly or unfriendly? They're neutral. They could care less. What does the One Supreme, which she had mentioned before, want for all the galaxies to live harmoniously together? Do we have a separate God from the One Supreme? No. What else do you know about this entity? Is it a being like the others? Read the Bible.
Huh. Wow,
that's something. I know it. To me, it's like just really a conundrum. It's something that it's like a gem that you look at from different angles, and it glistens in different ways. You know,
right, right. So, are Elsie and Tom still with us? That's someone asking.
Well,
have some questions about them.
So. Yeah, I should mention. Originally, they didn't want their names used, and so we called it Elise and Tom. But their real names, and they did come out with this story themselves after some time, and their name is Steve and Dawn Hess.
I was wondering why you mentioned Dawn. I couldn't understand why you're mentioning Dawn instead of Elise. Now I understand. So, that was my question. Are they actually talking about this? Have they talked about this on, you know, a lot of people go on coast to coast and places like that and talk about these incredible stories. Have they done anything like that?
They did. They did an interview with Jimmy Church they were on and interviewed along with me, but it was just one. And that was it.
That was it. Yeah. And are they really very uncomfortable in talking about this?
Yes.
Or they I mean, do they basically relive it?
I think that, you know, it's like somebody, I was just reading a book about World War I, All Quiet on the Western Front. And, you know, when these fellows came back from these terrible experiences, they didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
And I would say it's very similar. I don't think this is something that gives them any joy in reliving or discussing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I get that. It's, and a lot of people I've talked to over the years have to walk away from what their experience is and revisit it when they feel like it. You know, for instance, you know, Travis Walton has talked about being away from that whole situation for many years because it just horrified him. And, you know, he didn't, and there was a lot of negativity out there too about his story, and he just said, I don't need this. You know, I mean, you don't need, when you have something like this happen, you don't really need to convince anyone.
I think you're absolutely right. I think what's frustrating is that to them is that how do you really explain something like this? How do you really, if somebody's skeptical, I mean, it's not their job to convince them. It just isn't. They have it's almost like being, I hate to make this religious again, and I don't really want to, but it's almost like these prophets in the Bible. I mean, if you're a believer and a prophet talks to you, I guess you say this is a prophet. if you're not a believer and somebody talks to you like this, you say, this is a crazy person.
Yeah.
And as you say, who needs that? I mean, it was bad enough that it happened. They felt in a way privileged and in a way marked.
Right.
So it's a double-edged sword, and not necessarily – they wound up turning to religion. They became devout Mormons and actually relocated to Utah. But the bishop of the church told them they didn't have an alien encounter. They had an episode of possession.
Hmm. Hmm. Wow. So they went to Mormon. Wow. And I imagine, you know, this has been years now that this has happened.
Yes.
And had they had any other, you know, you talked about their 3-year-old or however old the child was that was spinning.
Yeah.
Other things happened along the way?
I think there were. Those are the two that stick out of my mind, but nightmares and this terrible feeling of being watched. Actually, Steve talks about it, and there's a quote, and it basically says, you know, how would you feel if you had a wife and children in a house in a nice suburban town, and you knew you couldn't protect them, that you couldn't do anything to protect them or to keep them out of harm's way or to keep these beings from meddling in their lives or kidnapping them or doing anything they wanted. It's a terrifying, horrible feeling.
And why do you think this case isn't, you know, there's been a lot of people in the chat that have said something along the lines where, wow, how come I've never heard about this one? And why do you suppose, I mean, I know there was only two people here involved. So that may be the issue. Mm-hmm. Because there's not a lot of cooperation and witnesses and things like that. But any other ideas why this isn't more well known than it is? I mean, it seems like an amazing event.
Yeah. No, it's that's an easy one to answer. Let's say in the case of a Travis Walton or some others, I mean, he's willing to discuss it. He's been on many shows, and they don't want to discuss it. They were on a show just to get it behind them. So, okay, we did this. They felt like it was important to the world to tell this story. And so they told it. They've been discouraged from involvement. As I mentioned, they became part of the church. The bishop said, you know, it happened. It's over. Move on. In other words, this was not about money. This was not about fame or celebrity. This was an incident that happened. They discussed it. A book was written. And so they left it alone. The other thing is, probably from my standpoint, I've been invited to conferences and those kinds of things. And as a rule, I don't do too many interviews about it. And I haven't been to any conferences, even though I've been invited. And that kind of is because, and I've actually been asked to write, you know, a sequel, another book, taking this further or similar kind of book. And I haven't. I haven't because, you know, for me, I feel pretty much the same way. I wrote the best book I know how to write.
Yeah.
I told the story as best I can tell it. And it's there. I don't feel like I want to, you know, shout it from the rooftops. I've written other books, as I mentioned. I have a new book that'll be out in September. And, you know, I have other stories to tell. But if you're asking me, this is the most significant book I've ever written.
Right. So this is just, you know, I mean, there's always people that are throwing critical things up here. And what he, meaning you, are asking us to accept uncritically what these people say. This is not the right way to go. Are we being sold a bridge to nowhere type of thing? Mm-hmm. And I just thought maybe I'd throw that at you. As a cop, you can address us.
Yeah, sure. It'd be my pleasure. You know, at the end of the day, I took them to the best, the Center for Psychiatry in Washington, D.C., one of the most reputable institutions of its kind. An incredibly reputable doctor, Dr. Bernard Vertone, examined them. They took tests. So that's critical. I took them to Dr. Anixter in Asheville, North Carolina, flew them in for days, and they were examined, and they were retrogressed, and it was videotaped. I had them take a polygraph test. I mean, really, within the scope of what I'm capable of, I'm not an institution. I'm not, you know, the CIA or the FBI or the NSA. You know, I examine this as closely and as thoroughly as I know how. And yeah, at the end of the day, whatever account you have, whether it's from Ronald Reagan, who has had UFO experiences, from Jimmy Carter, who has had UFO experiences and reported them, to the pilot on the Nimitz, or USS Roosevelt. I mean, at the end, people tell their story, they show what evidence they have, and you believe them or you don't believe them. I'm not selling anything, you know. I'm telling a story.
And how did they feel about your book?
I think they thought it was what's the word? Competently written, I would say. I don't think, you know, this came from tape. So I taped them for hours and hours and hours. And so most of the book comes directly from the tapes that that I recorded.
When's the last time that you spoke with them? I know you said they moved to Utah.
I haven't spoken to them. And again, probably for all the reasons we just discussed. I think maybe 2 or 3 years ago, two and a half years ago. Maybe 2.5 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Well, that is one heck of a story and scary. I mean, I want to say
one other thing, Martin.
Yeah.
When I first heard, if you were going to lie and if you were going to tell a story, first of all, these people are not that way. So we know that I think I've established as best I can. But if you were going to lie, if you were going to tell a story, would you talk about a UFO the size of, you know, a battleship? Would you talk about these different kinds of beings? To me, what makes it credible is the detail and the unabashed way they told this story. Mm-hmm. It would be easier to make this credible if you took some of it out. It would be easier to make some of it more. But this is the unvarnished story. And I find the fact that it's so incredible is what makes it so likely to be true.
I get that. I find myself when I just mentioned earlier, right after the break, that I have Albert Wayne coming up, and he talks about everyone pulled over on I-95 and they all, when they leave after this UFO encounter, they pull over to the Howard Johnson's and get ice cream.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, those weird things like that. I mean,
exactly.
Is just so bizarre. You know, it feels more credible.
Another thing that I found really sort of amazing, and I didn't know, there are two things to answer the question. Two things. One is Fife Symington.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've seen him interviewed and heard what he has to say. He talked about a UFO the size of a football field. Now, again, another credible guy. I mean, a pilot, et cetera, a fighter pilot in Vietnam, a governor. And he talked about this slowly moving overhead. And again, it would probably be a lot more credible. It would be untrue, but more credible if he said, well, it was about 50 feet in diameter. And, you know, it whooshed by at some speed. But no, it's the size of a football field, which is exactly the way they described the UFO that capped the valley above them. The other is that there are petroglyphs, cave drawings, that are in the mountains there, in the caves of in the Mojave. It was the Paiute Indians. And many of the drawings resemble to a T the way the illuminated figures are described. And there's a ground drawing can be seen from overhead in the Mojave, called the Mojave Twins. If you want to chill, just look that up, I guess, on the internet or somewhere, Mojave Twins, and what you'll see is exactly what they described as the illuminated figures looking like. So I find this, when you put it all together, the uniform described with the arrow, the truncated arrow pointing up. I talked to somebody else, and in an account that they had heard, there was that same kind of symbol. So these are little details that, as a, you know, as a somebody that it's a critical thinker, it starts to coalesce into something that's just, I think it's true. That's where I come out. And the doctors thought it was true as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's really quite amazing that you did go through all of that, you know, to make sure this was a credible story before you invested all the time, you know, into this thing. So, And I'm trying to put an image up, having trouble copying an image. I thought it would be easy to do. The Mojave Twins. Let me give it another shot here. I'll try one more time here. Because I can pull that right up. If it comes out here, I can pull that right up on the screen. I think I just did it. Let's see. Yep, I got it. It's coming. So, I mean, that whole story is just amazing to me. Here it is here, which is that's something you see from the sky. And I'll put that in the show notes for the audio listener. Interesting, because, yeah, I mean, people could say a lot about that. But, I mean, even how would you make something like that when you're on the ground? That's pretty amazing because it's so big.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that is a horrific story. I now know why that person in chat said early on that he wasn't going to sleep tonight. you know, and the funny thing is with that story is all the different beings, all you said, like maybe a hierarchy.
Yes.
You know, you have these gremlin type things. I mean, they can't get any scarier than that with red eyes, small little things running around. And what was their purpose? Was there a purpose to get them back into the camper, or what would their
honestly, purpose be? Honestly, I don't know, because I think they went back in the camper almost in a daze, you know, just like they were ordered to do it, and sort of zombies that were just mentally controlled in some way. I think probably, I mean, it seemed like they took great joy in scaring the hell out of them.
Yeah. Now, you said their faces look like leather, so they obviously saw them pretty close.
Yes, yeah.
And so was there some type of...
I mean, these were on the car. They were climbing on the
vehicle. How much was this... I'm trying to picture the time of day, how they could see these things. This was... They were stargazing, so obviously it was nighttime.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And so how did they see these things lit up? I mean, how could they see them?
Yeah. Well, they had red eyes, and the vehicle above them had these lights, and actually had smaller craft sort of attached to it, the huge UFO. And so there was a beam of light that was incredibly illuminated figures. But these things were all over the vehicle. I mean, they were literally in the trees and all over, like swarming. And
the thing you said about sound is something I hear all the time. You said it sounded like the valley was capped.
Yes.
And it goes back to the Berkshires incident and many other incidents where people say that all the sound is gone, almost like they're underwater. That's kind of the term. And so there's no sound at all. All the insects, everything you hear in the desert night is all of a sudden quieted for no apparent reason other than what's going on.
And the other thing, you know, I'm sure that, people familiar with this topic, as your listeners and viewers, I'm sure, are. The question becomes, were they sought out? Because Steve had this experience when he was 12, and this was some sort of follow-up, some sort of culmination. Or was it just happenstance that they stumbled onto this? There was a mining operation that maybe, you know, Alumax was getting various rare earths they were mining from that area, from the Mojave. Some of it used for laser weaponry and satellite technology. And maybe, you know, they were mining this for themselves and Steve and Dawn just stumbled onto them. So the question is, was this sort of a predestined thing and a, you know, a meant to be, or was it happenstance? And I think that's a very interesting question, because it bears light then on the phenomenon itself. Are people tracked for their, are they identified at an early stage, tracked as you would track maybe a shark or an animal that's endangered or that you want to study closely? And I don't know the answer to that, but maybe the answer is both. You know, maybe that that they were tracked, and maybe Steve was destined to have this happen, and that there was this operation going on simultaneous. It's hard to say, but I think it's an interesting question, and the answer is an important one.
Well, you know, if he hadn't wounded that mule deer and wanted to go back, she got her way and they went dancing, you know, there's all these little circumstances.
Well, look at Mid-Hill's campsite. He said it was highly unusual that that campsite would be filled up. So, you know, that's what makes it a fascinating story.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if I didn't, you know, we can look at life. All of us can look at life like this. If I hadn't gone out to a hot tub in Carmel Valley at exactly the time I did, and something didn't catch my eye, I wouldn't be sitting here right now talking to you.
Exactly. So, isn't that something, huh?
Yeah, it's all those little things. And then a great connection in my life all happened because of that, you know, all these different things. So anyway, I did open the lines. That number is 855-472-5483. Bill is standing by to take your call. Remember to mute your sound when you go in with Bill, so we don't have any feedback during the show. But the lines are open. We welcome your call. But let's switch gears, and people are welcome to call about that. But we have a half hour left, or a little bit under that, and let's go into what your next project is.
Well, talk about a coincidence, since we're on that line of reasoning. So I was a student at Georgetown University when the filming of The Exorcist was happening. So I guess I was a sophomore at the time, and all these cameras are there. And of course, The Exorcist at the time was like a mega hit book. I think it was on the bestseller list for 56 weeks or some crazy number. It sold like 14 million copies or so. And so they were filming. So Blatty, William Peter Blatty, had gone to Georgetown and probably said it there because of his experiences as a student, and said it even though the real case happened in Maryland. So anyway, one way or the other, I was a writer. I'd published a bunch of short stories and articles and my first novel. So I said, you know, this is my opportunity. William Peter Blatty, successful author. It's not every day I get to meet, you know, published authors, and I'm gonna get this book to him, and come hell or high water. Well, it wasn't so easy because a lot of people had been sending him manuscripts from all over. So finally, I found out that he was at the Key Marriott, the Key Bridge Marriott. So he had an office there at the time, along with William Friedkin, the director. So I went there. And there's a secretary, and they weren't there, but the secretary was. They were filming, I guess, and working on the project. And so I pretty much pled with this secretary. I said, you know, please give him my first novel, you know. It was loaded with typos. You know, you can imagine. But anyway, so she said, look behind me. And there was this big stack of manuscripts, because they're coming from all over the world. They're coming from Germany. God. They're coming from England. They're coming from Israel. They're coming from everywhere. He's not going to have time to read this, and he's certainly not going to have time to read yours, which is, you know, number 700 in the list here. So I said, look, you know, I'm just like he was a student here, I'm a student here. He wanted to be a writer, I want to be a writer. I said, I grew up in Newark, he grew up in Brooklyn, you know, not a lot of money, he came in on scholarship. I said, our backgrounds are very similar. We're very similar. Just give it to him and tell him that I'm just like he was when he was 18 years old. Mm-hmm. So he said, all right, I'll tell you what. I'll give it to him, but that's it. and give it to him and tell him what you told me. And that's all. I said, that's all I'm asking. So I went back to New Jersey where I lived with my parents. And I get a call over Thanksgiving weekend, and it's William Peter Blatty. And he says, I'd like your book. I want to meet with you. So we met, and he's passed away maybe 4 years ago. Just a really wonderful guy. I mean, I just have nothing but good things to say. And it's very encouraging. He read the book. He said, well, it's too personal, like a lot of first novels. You know, you don't have much experience, so you write about things that maybe aren't so commercial. He said, it's not commercial, but you have the brains and the will to be a fine novelist. And I'll tell you what, you write a different kind of book, you know, and one that people will be more interested in, and I'll help you get it published. More than that, I moved because I'm in Aspen. I have a place in Beverly Hills, and I'm going to be moving quite a bit probably over the next couple of years. I'll have my secretary keep you informed of where I'm living so you can contact me. Now, you don't get a better offer than that. So I was a policeman at the time after I graduated then, and I was writing this book. So I went to the Beverly Hills Hotel during Oscar week to turn over the new manuscript. So I did, and there's a story behind that. He had death threats, so I was supposed to meet him at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and he had moved out. So I panicked. I had almost no money. But finally, somebody gave me an address. One of the hotel people gave me an address, and I met with him. He was true to his word. He helped me get my first book published. But we had a lifelong friendship.
That's nice.
So often I'd write something, and I'd show up on his doorstep, and he said, what are you doing here? So he gave me a story, and it was about a woman, and her name, a pseudonym, was Christine Beecham, and she was displayed all the signs of demonic possession. And she was studied in 1898 to 1901 by William James, the famous William James. His brother was Henry James, the famous author. William James was the first professor in Harvard Medical School to teach abnormal psychology. Dr. Morton Prince, who was a peer of Sigmund Freud, Dr. Waterman from the Waterman Penn fortune, and the clairvoyant Leonora Piper. And they studied her from different angles for 3 or 4 years. All the transcripts were at the Harvard Medical School Library. Blatty got me access to it. And it's the most harrowing and most credible story you'll ever read, because it's totally documented, letters, transcripts, photographs. And I wrote this book about it, and it took me a long, long time to do. And it's called The Unwelcomed, The Curious Case of Clara Fowler, and it'll be out in September.
Wow, great. Well, we have someone on the line that is going to be talking, I'm sure, about our previous conversation.
Yes.
And that is Rob from Florida. Rob, you're live on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good evening, Martin. It's great to speak to you again. Last time I spoke to you, I was up in Maine, and now we are headed to New Mexico and Arizona, and our first stop's going to be Roswell, and looking forward, never been out there. And Mr. Felber, very interesting story. You mentioned, and I think this is the first time I've ever heard this, where these beings discuss a superior force. We call it God. They call it something else. But that's fascinating. Can you expand upon that just a bit? Because they appeared to recognize or identify there's a superior force over the whole universe. If you could expand on that, it'd be very interesting.
Sure. No, I'd be delighted. And this is one of the things that makes this story sort of an enigma. The way that Dawn, in this sort of robotic voice I talked to, almost being channeled, it seemed, talked about the One Supreme. And one of the things that was strange, but over the years, maybe isn't as strange as I first thought. They said that is the One Supreme like a leader of some kind? And she says, no, it's a God, but very strong. It's a God. And What does the One Supreme want? He wants to unite the five galaxies. He talks about five galaxies. The interesting thing, too, he says, we are made in its image, but the others aren't, meaning the beings that she encountered and whatnot aren't. But humans are. And maybe it's because, and she said that they're exploring and want to know about human emotions. And I wonder if the thing that separates humans from maybe any other species is the ability to love.
Fascinating. Yeah, it's, you know, this you hear this on these accounts. These beings typically don't have any emotions. You know, and we're, of course, you know, brimming with emotions.
Yeah, for sure. Sometimes for the good and sometimes not for the good, right?
that's for sure. And now, when you say galaxies, did you equate that as like our Milky Way galaxy? And of course, there's a million galaxies across our entire universe. Do you think they were referring to our galaxies or the entire universe?
My guess would be, and again, it's a guess, no better than yours. My impression was that it's the entire universe. And this is what I was getting at a little bit when I said my thinking has changed. When I first, I'm not a particularly religious guy. So just put it in that context. I mean, I have nothing against religion, but I'm not a very religious fellow. But originally, and I heard a physicist, an astrophysicist talk about this not too long ago, maybe a month ago, something like that. And it struck a chord with me. He said, originally, meaning 15 years ago or so, people thought that there were many Earths, you know, that there were thousands of Earths, maybe hundreds of thousands of Earths, and perhaps human beings or something like human beings that existed. But as they start to study it, the physicist said, more and more, the uniqueness of the Earth becomes the spotlight of things, and the uniqueness of human existence may be a lot more rare than we thought 15 years ago. So, for example, you ever hear Francis Crick?
No.
Nobel Prize in Science for discovering the DNA. He was the co-founder of the DNA helix. And he said, I don't believe in evolution. I believe that for the human brain to be created and evolve over the course of 10 billion years or whatever the time frame was, is as likely as a tornado going through a junkyard, leaving behind a 747 jet fully assembled that revs up, takes off, and flies to Europe. He believes in transpermia, direct transpermia, and that we are the descendants, the DNA came from another universe.
Well, that's fascinating.
Because, you know, the human body is such an amazing organism when you think about it. I mean, you see, you know, the spine, these weightlifters lifting 700 pounds. I mean, it is a little hard to believe the lightning bolt in the primordial soup made this incredibly perfect body. But well, thank you so much. I'm sure there's others that'd like to ask questions, and thank you for coming on. Thank you, Martin.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. So yeah, that was interesting. And I was sent this week a scientific paper that kind of goes along with that theory in a way, that it looks like our DNA may have been altered. There's some type of scientific paper along the way. And I have been taught, I've said a number of times on this show that I have to think that, you know, it is kind of unusual that we could develop our brains the way we did in such a quick fashion of only 300,000 years or so, or 150,000 years. I mean, for evolution to make that happen, it seems like a big jump to me. But I mean, I'm not a scientist. I'm not an anthropologist.
But Frick was. I mean, this is what Frick, you know, this was his field of study. He wrote a book called Life. And that's where he put forward his theory. By the way, it didn't go over well. A lot like John Mack from Harvard.
Yes.
So, you know, you become ostracized. And even though this was a guy that won the Nobel Prize in Science, people poo-pooed this idea of direct transpermia.
You know, kind of along the same lines of our conversation tonight, I remember seeing, I'm trying to remember, he's a well-known Harvard professor. He's talking about John Mack, and he says, yes, it's okay for you to believe in the spirits in the sky, meaning religion. But he says, but don't believe in aliens or you'll really get in trouble.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So that, and John Mack didn't actually say he was believing in aliens, but he did really take the abduction, the people, he took them serious at their word that they weren't psychotic. Mm-hmm. We have a regular caller. I haven't heard from him in a while. Andy from Connecticut, you are live on the show. Yeah, Andy, welcome.
Hi guys. Yeah. I always listen either later or live, but don't comment because I'm still working. But Ron, great show. I read the book and I've seen the Paranormal Witness episode a few times. I just wanted your thoughts on, you know, from a religious perspective, what you think of the hypnosis testimony from Dawn about the aliens saying that our planet is special. We were created in God's image and they weren't, or their planet wasn't. And that, you know, what you think of that. I've always thought that fact, or that I've had the suspicion that is why the aliens are so curious about us, because we are very unique. And I'll take your answer off the air and let somebody else call in.
Thanks. Thank you, Andy.
Yeah, I mean, people, I guess anthropomorphic is the word. Yeah. You know, people tend to humanize things. So, you know, you are a human and you look at it from a human point of view. And so what you tend to see is greatly influenced by that. I think that, like I said, what resonated with me was this astrophysicist, and it had nothing to do with religion. He was talking about science and just the evolution, the recent evolution of people's thinking, scientists thinking about, you know, at first was, oh, there's all these places that have the same conditions as Earth and this could happen. But apparently it really isn't that way, that a unique set of circumstances, it isn't just that there's water, it isn't just that there's oxygen or whatever it might be, that it isn't just that there's carbon available. It's an incredibly unique set of circumstances coming together in a very specific way to create human life, and particularly the ability to reason and look into the future and show emotions, emotions generally, but particularly, I suppose, emotions that go outside oneself. So, for example, if Darwin is absolutely right and everything's about survival, how do you explain, you know, somebody sacrificing their life for another person? Hmm. That shouldn't happen. Shouldn't happen. How do you explain a soldier protecting his platoon, a husband defending his family, people doing things that go way outside of the idea of moving, of their whole logic being for them to survive. So the idea of, I don't know, a Mother Teresa or whatever, people that are humanitarians and that prefer giving to taking, how do you explain that if everything is about survival instinct? So clearly everything isn't about survival instinct, and this is a unique set of experiences. And maybe it's not so prevalent. Maybe there aren't a million Earths and a million reasoning, feeling beings like us. And like I said, it sounds self-centered and very anthropomorphic to talk that way, but maybe it's true. You know, I understand that the Earth goes around the sun, not in reverse.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, sometimes things that seem not so likely turn out to be the answer, you know?
Right. Very interesting. We have Eric on the line from Boston. Eric, you are live on the air. Welcome to the show.
All right. Thanks, Martin. I'm hearing more of this comment on the aliens not being made in God's image. And am I right in that interpretation is because they're not being seen as positive, that the kind of the assumption is made that they don't have feelings, they can't love. Am I getting that wrong?
Well, I mean, what Dawn says under hypnosis is that they don't have emotions like we do. And to them, it's very curious and something that warrants study. And they don't understand that, but they also understand that if there's going to be a communion, as they say, right, like in the Whitley Strieber sense, if there's going to be a communion, they have to understand human emotions. And so that's yeah. sort of a, you know, you talk about studying reproductive systems and studying the physical aspects. What they're talking about is studying the psychological aspects because, yeah, they don't have emotions like we do. This is a curiosity to them. And in order to communicate in a way that doesn't, I guess, scare the hell out of everybody, they need to understand how to approach this. And I think that's the message that I got from what Dawn was saying.
Yeah.
Anything else, Eric?
I think it's an interpretation on their part that they don't have those feelings and stuff. And you know, if I'm to go with who's the higher intelligence, I'd have to go with them. The chances sure. are what people generally don't seem to understand is that extraterrestrial intelligence is above and beyond our own. Mm-hmm. And so, okay, what I'd also like to know is if you know the Travis Walton story, as years have gone by, Travis is much more comfortable with saying, you know, it was more like an ambulance call and right. they saved his life and they've got more positive things to say about it. Do these people, have they ever considered that their interpretation is why they were so fearful? That other people, there could be other people, given the situation, might actually have enjoyed it.
Yeah, I know. I take what you're saying seriously. I mean, I think intelligence, clearly, we can't do what they can do. We're not showing up on their planet. We're not showing up where they live. But I think more than anything, I don't think that it's necessarily an evil thing. I mean, this is one way of interpreting it. But the other way of interpreting it, look what we do to chimpanzees. Or what scientists do to animals. I mean, basically, it isn't that they hate these animals or they're trying to torment them. They're studying them. And so there are dissections. There's things that you do that are awful if you look at it from the point of view of the animal or the test subject. I think that that's more. I mean, I would never argue that we're more intelligent than these beings. Clearly, that's not true and not possible. But it is possible that we have a set of experiences and maybe a set, call it emotions, feelings, that they don't have. I mean, that's clearly possible as well. I don't necessarily think they're evil. I think that they were scientists.
Okay.
Yeah.
Could it be that they have just as much of emotion as we do, but they were absolutely perplexed with the horror, the emotions of horror in these people? And yes, they became more, they're concerned and they were very interested in, you know, why this reaction of utter horror? What is going on here with these people that they're like that?
I mean, that's really an interesting point of view. And I think that's as likely as any take on it.
Thank you, Eric.
I did want to mention, Eric, I don't claim to know exactly what this means. I don't know what it means. I look at it, as I mentioned, it's like a sort of gem. You hold it up to the light and you see what you see. And if you hold it from a particular angle, it looks one way. You hold it from another angle, and it looks quite different.
Do you think, one of the emotions I think of, and one of the words that seems to come up a lot in these conversations with people is the emotion, or whatever you would call it, of love. You know, is love an evolutionary thing so we survive, or is it more than that? You know, I mean, I know it's kind of a philosophical question I'm asking you, but I'm wondering if that was ever any part of the regression talk that happened, that particular thing.
No, it didn't come up as something like love. That word never came up. Emotions came up quite often. Feelings came up quite often, but not love. But I would venture to say that in retrospect, what might have also been of great interest to these beings is the love a mother has for her kids.
Right.
Because she was incredibly concerned about the well-being of her children more than herself.
Yes. So if they were observing that, that would be perplexing, probably. Maybe not. I don't know what their evolution would be. But here's one more question, and we're just at the end here. Did any of the alphabet agencies ever contact Elise or Tom or Don or Steve, whatever they want to be called these days?
No.
How about any other people contact them, any investigators, really, you know, other than yourself?
Well, really, their name was kept, you know, they were using pseudonyms, and so no one really could identify them to track them down. If you're asking about agencies, the CIA, NSA, or whatever, no, the answer is no.
Yes. Excellent. Well, one more time, if you would give the name of your book that's due out this fall.
Yeah, it's called The Unwelcome, The Curious Case of Clara Fowler. And of course, this is the Mojave incident, and it's available on Amazon or wherever.
Yeah.
I have a website, Ron, too. RonFelber.com. That's simple.
Well, you know, I didn't even find that, so I can't remember how we connected, but I will put that in the show notes and down in the notes here below this video as well. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. You've been a great guest.
Thank you, Martin. A pleasure talking to you.
All right. Take care. All right, everyone. As a reminder, we'll be back next week with Chris Lambright. And the following week, I don't have any of that up in front of me, what's going on. But we have some great guests coming along the way. Don't forget, this Thursday night, we have the J. Allen Hynek's son, Paul Hynek, is going to be on talking about immortality within our reach, which is a really interesting topic. Thank you again, everyone. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.